Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome back to our French President's Special. We've done De Gaulle, we've done Pompidou, we've done D'Estaing, all of whom were on the right. And now we come to the first left-wing president, François Mitterrand, who came to power in 1981. But, Dominic, he did not begin as a left-winger, did he?
No, he didn't, actually. It's funny, because actually Chirac, who succeeded him, began on the left.
He was a communist.
And Mitterrand began on the kind of conservative, nationalist, Catholic right in the 1930s. I mean, Mitterrand and Chirac are both, they are two immensely kind of vulpine, feline, cynical men who make British politicians, I think, look like absolute paragons of principle. So Mitterrand, born in 1916, comes from a Catholic conservative family in the southwest, in the Charente. You were talking before the break about the war. I mean, Mitterrand has quite a dubious war.
He does.
He spends the first half basically working as a civil servant in the Vichy.
Well, he's a POW, isn't he? He gets captured.
He is
and, to be fair, and he escapes, in inverted commas, and then, before you know it, is working in the Vichy government.
Yeah.
And there's the definite whiff of something that doesn't entirely hang together there.
But then he flees to London in 1943 and is involved with the resistance. So he sort of, I mean, most people I think would say about Mitterrand is he has a foot in both camps. And actually, you know what, we could easily beat up on him about that, but most French men and women had a foot in both camps one way or another. I mean, the lines were not exactly clear. Well, okay, De Gaulle didn't in the 1940s. But apart from De Gaulle and apart from a handful of people, you know, most people are sort of treading a fine line between.
But I just mentioned that because Mitterrand does kind of, you know, he moves to the left, and he kind of makes a name for himself as someone who is the anti-De Gaulle.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. So when De Gaulle came in 1958, redoes the constitution, sets up the Fifth Republic, Mitterrand is quite outspoken in opposing him. And Mitterrand is also the person who stands against him during De Gaulle's first kind of national sort of democratic presidential election. Do you see this, that Mitterrand was also accused at this point of faking an assassination attempt against himself?
Yes, yes.
Observatory affair.
Very, very weird. And De Gaulle refuses to make political capital out of it on the grounds that Mitterrand may end up becoming president, and therefore to do so would lower the dignity of the
presidency. Sounds to me, I saw that story and I thought, that sounds to me like a story that Mitterrand has told himself. De Gaulle wouldn't use that against me because he knew that one day I would be president of France.
Well, no, because that would imply that that Mitterrand was up to no good. So I don't think Mitterrand would have originated it.
But did De Gaulle really say one day that young man will be? I don't know. That sounds very kind of like Alfred the Great going to Rome to me.
Well, absolutely. I mean, but it's it exemplifies De Gaulle's elevated sense of the presidency.
Maybe.
And that ultimately the standing of the presidency is greater than the political rivalry between left and right.
Maybe.
So I think it's a kind of paradigmatic story.
Well, Mitterrand Mitterrand comes in 1981, and he's been in French politics forever. And he's very good at, I think, playing the president. You know, I think that
absolutely.
Sort of Hollywood.
The hauteur.
yeah, the Ota, the he of course has pretty good relations with, you know, Margaret Thatcher, contrary to what everyone thinks. He famously says she has the eyes of Caligula and the lips of Marilyn Monroe. He's a great pal of hers in the Falklands War. She handbags him in European summits and he doesn't really mind. He's got this sort of charming lounge lizard side that I think French presidents should have and actually generally do have.
But he starts off incredibly to the left, doesn't he?
Yeah, and then abandons
he kind of
that,
nationalizes
basically.
Everything, and then he kind of gets forced into a corner by the millions of Zurich.
Basically, he has a thing called the 110 propositions. So he has a wealth tax, and he's going to increase the minimum wage. He's going to nationalize lots of things. Very kind of Benite, to use a British term, program. He comes in with that in 81, and by about 83, 84, he's abandoned that, and they have this thing called the turning towards rigor, which is actually masterminded by his finance minister, Jacques Delors, later boss of the European Commission.
Up yours, Delors.
Yeah, as the sun. It's good to see you ventriloquizing the sun, Tom. I think you should do that more often.
We've had Gotcha, so that's the other famous headline.
So he sort of moves back towards the center, which is quite a common thing, I think, for French presidents, that over time, They start with great ambitions, whether on the right or the left, and over time they basically end up being, to survive, they become kind of technocratic.
But it's more than that, isn't it? It's also that if you are truly to be president of all the French, you have to be in the centre.
Yeah, there are lots of French.
Because you're playing a kind of monarchical role.
Yeah, that's fair.
So if you're very party pre, if you're very much of the right, very much of the left, it's harder to do that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's fair enough. But the other thing with Mitterrand is that he conforms to all the sort of stereotypes of French presidents. So first of all, he publishes false reports about his health and does so from the very beginning, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's still, I think, not entirely clear how long he was ill for. So how long he had prostate cancer, which eventually killed him. So how long he had that for during his presidency. He also gets up to various sort of dodgy things. He wiretaps journalists. Bizarrely, Tom, did you see this? One of the people he wiretaps is the Bond girl, Carole Bouquet from Fewer Eyes Only.
Why was he doing that?
I think she was going out with a journalist at the time or something.
Right.
But anyway, perhaps we should do a podcast about Bond girls too.
Who've been wiretapped, yeah.
To clear that up.
Yeah.
But
also he builds Paris.
Yes.
So the pyramid in the Louvre and what else does he do? I can't remember.
He does lots of
Musée d'Orsay, all that kind of stuff.
He does lots of stuff in Paris. But also
Jacques Lang, his culture minister.
He is his culture minister.
Yeah.
But also there are two other things about Mitterrand that I think are entertaining. So one is the fact that he's obviously got the secret family life.
Mm.
So now this is absolutely extraordinary. And actually, at first you think, oh, it's actually quite a touching story. But then when you look into it, it's a really dodgy story. He has this relationship for 33 years with the Louvre's sculpture expert, a woman called Anne Pinjot, I think her name is. And you sort of think, oh, he's got this, you know, very French behavior. He's got this other family and he's got a daughter with her and stuff. But actually, when I looked into it, they met, Tom. Did you see this? He was in his early 40s and she was 14.
So French presidents and women of a very disproportionate age. This is another
theme. Because, and get this, they met because her father played golf with him at the seaside and brought him back to the house afterwards for a drink or something and said, oh, I'd like to introduce my
14-year-old daughter.
My 14-year-old barely teenage daughter. They ended up having a 33-year relationship and having a daughter called Mazarine, who only basically emerged into the public spotlight in the 1990s when she was already in her 20s. So that side of things is...
But he had a son as well, didn't he?
Yes, I can't.
A Swedish journalist.
That's right.
He was called.
He did indeed.
Which is a very improbable name for the son of a French president.
It's a sort of very Viking name, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like something out of the Northmen.
But then there's also Tom Mitterrand's sort of, you know, Mitterrand shuffling off this mortal coil. So he leaves office in 1995, but he's already basically terminally ill. And he dies on the 8th of January 1996. But before that, he has a last meal.
Yes.
Have you studied Mitterrand's last meal?
I knew about this. So he has, as you'll know, I'm very keen on conservation.
Yeah, on birds.
And not killing endangered birds.
So he has oysters and foie gras. Foie gras already, you know, controversial in some quarters. And he has this great sort of French delicacy, an ortolan bunting. You know these birds? These endangered birds. And the way they eat them, they force feed them first. That's very French culinary behavior. Then they drown the bird in Armagnac. Yeah. I mean, they literally drown it, sort of Duke of Clarence style. And then the way you eat it is the bird is roasted. You take the bird by its head.
And you put it, a napkin over your head.
Right, a napkin or a towel over your own head. You eat the bird whole, crunching all the bones. Then you have to spit out all the bones underneath your towel. And this is the most tremendous...
It is apparently the most rapturous culinary experience.
Is it?
Apparently.
I think all the stuff about the bones puts me off for one thing.
Eat an ortolan and die, which is what Mitterrand did.
Well, it is what he did.
Because that was his last meal, wasn't it?
I think the thing about putting a towel over your head, I mean, is that going to catch on? Surely not. Supposedly that's because you can't... some people claim that's because it intensifies the aroma. And others say it's because you can't... You know, what you're doing is a sin and God can't see you doing it.
I think both of those are entirely plausible.
Do you?
I think we've summed up the key events of Mitterrand's presidency there.
Absolutely. He eating birds.
He ate a bird soaked in Armagnac.
Hanging around with teenagers.
Two illegitimate children. And did he do anything else, Dominic? He negotiated with Thatcher.
He blew up the Rainbow Warrior.
And Bush. he blew up the Rainbow Warrior. But he played a key role in the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, German unification.
German unification.
Yeah.
And he had a moving ceremony, didn't he, with Chancellor Kohl.
They held hands. Yeah,
and stood in the rain together.
Yes.
As a symbol of Franco-German amateur.
Chancellor Kohl, I think, is a man who would eat a bird. But I don't think Chancellor Kohl was a man of such... Although Chancellor Kohl actually ended up in later life, as some listeners may remember, being sort of imprisoned by his...
The evil nurse, didn't he?
Yeah. So,
I'd rather have Mitterrand's fate, I think. Probably.
It's all, I mean, the more you do this, British politics just looks
so tawdry.
I think it looks incredibly sensible by comparison.
It looks bourgeois, doesn't it?
None of this happens to John Major. I mean, he's never eaten a bird with a towel over his head.
Well, and talking of bad behavior, the next president. Is none other than Jacques Chirac, who we mentioned earlier. And he's absolutely a constant, isn't he? I mean, he is there the whole way through.
Yeah.
Like a kind of bad smell.
Chirac basically got involved with politics when he was about two or something.
And was
constantly sort of plotting and being prime minister.
So he's prime minister twice.
In the 70s, he falls out with Giscard. And then,
so he's prime minister under Giscard, and then he's prime minister
under
Mitterrand. That's the first example of cohabitation, which you mentioned, where you have people from different parties, kind of once a prime minister and once a president.
Yeah.
And in between that, he was also mayor of Paris.
Well, Chirac is too young to have been involved in the war. He's born in 1932. His father was an aircraft company executive. He was a communist, as you said, when he was young. And he went to Sciences Po. He went to... Enar, so he's another Enarch. He's from those elite kind of training colleges for French politicians. He worked for Pompidou. Pompidou called him the bulldozer. But I think the thing about Chirac...
In English?
Le bulldozer.
So he's le bulldozer.
Yeah. The thing about Chirac is his absolute world-class cynicism, I think, isn't it? I mean, he is an absolutely shameless grafter, completely corrupt... Kind of will, you know, unprincipled, but he wears that, and
the key kind of example of that opportunism is the way. Well, he changes the constitution, doesn't he? So that the term of office will be 5 years rather than seven.
Yeah,
but also to kind of stiff the left, he makes it easier for the far right to participate in the electoral process, and the far right basically means Jean-Marie Le Pen, who we'll come to in due course. And it's under Chirac that you have the kind of the development where Jean-Marie Le Pen makes it to the second round in the 2002 election.
Yes. And so people vote for him and they say better to vote for the crook than the fascist.
Yeah, better the crook than the fascist. He, and I think everyone had been expecting that the man who had served as his prime minister in a second experience of cohabitation, Lionel Jospin, the socialist leader, would make it through. And I always adored Jospin because he looked exactly like a baby owl. Do you remember him?
I remember Jospin.
Adorable little. Imagine him falling out of a nest.
He looked a bit like that guy Jolyon Morme, didn't he?
Yes, but more like an owl than
James
okay.
Bond.
All right. Well, the two things about Chirac that I think are more... obviously, he opposed Iraq.
Yes, so he opposed Iraq and he was very rude about British cooking.
Cooking. He said it was only Finnish cooking was worse. And I think Finnish cooking is now very fashionable. So Chirac looks a fool.
It is, yeah.
but Chirac was colossally corrupt as mayor of Paris. He was mayor of Paris from 1977 to 1995. It was a new job. He did a bit of a kind of Boris Johnson. So he took this sort of this new job running a capital city and he used it as a platform to advance his kind of national ambitions. But when he was running Paris, they had vote rigging, they had tons of kickbacks on public housing, lots of people had made up fictional jobs, sort of dozens of fictional jobs that actually were, you know, he was paying money to people in his party. He spent hundreds of thousands of euros on gardening for himself and members of his own party. And he spent, would you believe, 15 million euros a year, Tom, on food, which seems, even if you're buying those birds,
yeah,
that's a lot of birds.
The autolair. Well, I remember I was writing Rubicon during this period of Chirac's presidency, where lawyers were kind of sniffing around his record,
yeah,
and there were all kinds of talks of bringing him to trial for corruption, and basically he wanted office in 2002. Because it would continue to give him immunity.
Exactly.
And that's very yeah. like Caesar in Gaul having to keep up his term of office so that he can't be brought to trial. And I remember that as a kind of a parallel. That
he's a very, very high class. In that side of his life, he's a very high class Silvio Berlusconi. Using yeah. sort of...
Berlusconi was the same. Yeah.
So using political office to protect himself. He also has this, again, this sort of colourful sex life. So his wife, Bernadette... He and his wife called each other Vu instead of Chu, to the ends of their lives.
Very formal.
Which you might think very formal, but also I think was a reflection of their slightly strained, because she basically said after he died, you know, I stayed with him. I didn't really want to. He treated me very badly. His chauffeur would take him on all these assignations. And I've read two different versions of this. So one is that the chauffeur would call him Mr. 15 Minutes, shower included.
yes, I.
And the other was that they called him Mr. 3 Minutes, Sharon included. but either way, anyway, it wasn't flattering. And so Chirac was his most spectacular liaison was supposedly with the actress Claudia Cardinale, who was in The Leopard and Once Upon a Time. She starred with Alain Delon, Tom.
Yeah, so it all connects. Yeah, it all connects. But he must. I mean, he had achievements as well.
I think actually the funny thing is Chirac. He looks like a French president. When you see him at those sort
they
of summits.
They all do. He has that kind of French president nose that Destang had, that Mitterrand had, that Chirac had.
Yeah.
Chirac and then incarnates. Sarkozy, who follows him, lets the side down.
Well, Chirac hated Sarkozy because Sarkozy had backed one of his rivals in the 1990s, a guy called Edouard Balladur.
But before we get into Sarkozy, let's quickly take a break for some publicité. See you in a sec.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. So, Dominic, Sarkozy succeeds Chirac in 2007.
Sarkozy is obviously a different generation. It's 1955. And actually, I think the French presidents start to become less interesting from this point because...
I think Sarko is pretty interesting.
But Sarko is a ludicrous character, isn't he?
Yes, but...
I mean, he's nothing but a ludicrous and corrupt
character.
Well,
so he wears platform heels.
Yeah.
He again, has a kind of great marital record because he has three wives, doesn't he? Of whom the most famous is Carla Bruni.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Who's about 3 feet taller than he is.
But he was also married to a model.
Yeah.
And he married someone else who's, and one of their sons is a hip hop producer.
I saw that.
So
yeah. Sarkozy kind of made his name.
He's president bling, wasn't he?
Partly as a sort of hardline interior minister.
So when there were,
yeah, he basically says, I think it's about 2005. He says, "I will clean up this scum. I will clean this scum off the streets with a basically a pressure hose."
Yeah. So that's in the banlieue, isn't it? And there were, three boys, and they get kind of electrocuted in a power station or something. And
that's
then
right.
It's a whole series of riots. And Sarkozy was the home minister at that time.
That's right.
And he said he wanted, he called them rakai, so yeah. Scum.
Yeah.
And said that he wanted to apply a pressure hose to them. And so that was actually, I mean, it got him lots of blowback from the left.
But lots of votes.
But yeah. And that, of course, is, I guess, a kind of growing theme in French politics is a kind of, you know, a kind of a hard right edge to narratives about race and particularly Islam.
Yeah, I think that's true, because Islam was not really an issue in French politics in the 1970s and 80s, even though there were lots of settlers from, I mean, when I say settlers, I mean, there were lots of pieds noirs, and there were also lots of what the French would call Arabs, because that's the word that they would often use. That wasn't a theme in the 70s and 80s. It was anti-immigration theme, but it wasn't anti-Islamist or Islamic. But that obviously became a much bigger issue from the 1990s
on. Well, so Sarkozy's interior minister during the decade after 9/11.
Yeah.
And actually kind of Islamist attacks in France are probably the worst in the continent, in Europe. So that is kind of his forging ground. And I think the reason why you say he's a comical character is that an important part of his image is this kind of hard man pressure hosing the banlieue, all that kind of stuff. And yet he's very small, wears platform heels and can't quite carry it off.
Yeah, because the hard man thing is posturing, political posturing, I think. But the first thing he does such Sarkozy behavior, sort of the first thing, you know, the first thing he did when he became president was to double his own salary, which I think is exactly what you would expect. Yeah. And obviously he then is involved in the most, again, more hideous scandals, wiretapping. He's accused of taking 50 million euros from the Libyans, from the Libyan government, which, I mean, when you think that he was the great...
Well, he joins with Cameron, doesn't he?
Yeah, he was the great sort
the
of
war
progenitor
against,
of the attack on...
On Libya.
Yeah, and I basically with Sarkozy and then with his successor, you basically get two failed presidencies, two people who don't play the de Gaullish part and who don't represent in any way the grandeur of France. I mean, Sarkozy, because his ambition, I think, is too naked, and because he is nothing but pure ambition in many ways.
And greed.
And then he is succeeded in 2012 by a man who basically, he bills himself as Mr. Normal. That's the phrase he uses. But the phrase that most people use to describe François Hollande is Monsieur Flamby. And a Flamby is kind of, that's like a kind of creme caramel, like a custard pudding.
Kind of wobbles, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he's... Yeah.
Although he has an excellent name.
What?
And do you know the name of his eldest son?
Tom Hollande.
Oui. Thomas Hollande. Hollande. Yeah, it's an excellent name.
But Tom, he brings the Hollande dynasty into slight disrepute, doesn't he?
No, so we point out that he has an E on the end of his name.
Right.
Otherwise, you're right, he would bring shame on the name of Hollande.
Because he really is a lesson. He's, I think, the least interesting of all French presidents, because he was an énarque, he was a special advisor to Mitterrand, spokesman for Jospin.
Well, and he's married to Ségolène Royal.
Who had been beaten by Sarkozy in 2007.
Yes.
Yeah.
And who in a way is kind of a much more interesting dynamic figure.
Yeah.
And something we haven't mentioned up till now is that all of these presidents have been men.
Yeah.
Ségolène Royal was supposed to, she was the one who was supposed to become president.
But Hollande, I had a look at Hollande's campaign website, Tom, from 2012. If you click on FrançoisHollande.com or .fr or whatever, do you know what it is? It's actually now a website selling air conditioning units.
Is it?
Which all about Hollande. Because he became, so when he became president, we talked this thing about the grandeur. He was inaugurated during this terrible rainstorm. And there are the most hilarious images of him. He looks kind of an unprepossessing bloke anyway, but he's absolutely drenched. I mean, he's standing there with this very Clouseau-like sort of sense of dignity, as though someone's basically, as though God is pouring a bucket of water over
it's
his head.
It's kind of Monsieur Hulot.
Yeah, it is that.
Kind of quality.
Do you know the nadir of his approval rating in the French public?
14% or something? No. 12%?
4%.
4%, goodness.
4%.
Well, was that, because he also, I mean, considering that he's not the most prepossessing of men.
No.
I mean, he Chirac, Mitterrand, I mean, you can see there's a kind of suavity, a
they're
vulpine
men you can
quality,
see in
as
the
you said.
Cocktail lounge of a mid-century bar.
They are like foxes in a chicken coop.
Yeah.
But very, very kind of spectacular. He splits up with from Royale.
Yeah, she throws him out, I think, because he's been carrying on with a journalist, Valerie
Triavele.
Yeah.
And then he dumps on her.
He does.
With an actress, Julie Gayet.
Yeah.
And he was photographed famously, wasn't he, on a kind of little moped.
A scooter, wearing
a very, very unprepossessing crash helmet.
But the great thing about that was that the guy who was driving the scooter, he made him stop off to buy some croissants. You sort of think this could be invented by some terrible 70s British sitcom.
You know, I'd
writer,
love to hear but... is an equivalent of this podcast doing the same to British prime ministers. I mean, I'm sure they'd seem equally risible, but
maybe they would. I don't know. Yeah, maybe they'd concentrate on the same really crucial issues that we've been concentrating on.
Their love life. Do we have anything to say about Hollande's policies beyond the fact that he got rained on?
No, I mean, obviously, Hollande is in power in the second half of the 2010s, a pretty wretched period, I suppose you would say, for the sort of Western democratic world anyway. And pretty soon after he's inaugurated, I think the French make up their minds he's a busted flush. And of course, he has this young industry minister who he's recruited from Rothschilds, who is Emmanuel Macron. And in 2016, I think it is, so Hollande hasn't been there very long. Macron founds his own party, En Marche, with his own initials, and basically then leaves the government. And Hollande doesn't know what to make of it. But Macron, unlike Hollande, despite the fact that he's so young and frankly so strange, is brilliant at playing. He plays the grandeur of France in a way that Hollande and Sarkozy were incapable of doing, don't you think?
Well, I do. And I think that Macron, although he... I mean, he immolates the Socialist Party that had been led by Hollande and of which Macron had been a minister. He also immolates the Gaullist Party because the Gaullist candidate, François Fillon, gets caught up in inevitably a scandal involving his Welsh wife, Penny.
That's right.
Who had been supposedly employed as a secretary and had been paid quite a lot for secretarial services. So essentially... Macron, in a way, is the kind of the quintessence of a French president, because we're talking about the idea of the president rising above party politics in that kind of Gaullist sense. In a way, Macron is the most Gaullist president of all, because he actually destroys the party system.
Yeah.
He leaves. I mean, he has immolated the parties of the centre-right and the centre-left, so that all that is left now in French politics are... the two extremes of the left and the right.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think because Macron would say, I'm above such petty distinctions. I'm above ideology. I represent France, the grandeur
and he
of
does.
France. Yeah, and
I think.
But Macron also has that thing of being slightly strange.
Oh, I mean, indisputably. I mean, he's another one for the kind of the weird age gap.
Well, I mean,
it works better for him because this time it's his wife who's 24 years older, I think.
Yes, they met when he was 15, and
that's
she was
in Amiens, isn't it?
And she at school, she was his drama teacher. She was 39, and he was and married with children. He was 15, and of course, you know, he's all his life. He's basically had to cope with people laughing at that, sneering at it, whatever. But actually, what is even more extraordinary, Tom, his best man at his wedding.
Yeah.
Did you see this?
Yeah.
His best man was born in 1924.
Yeah.
So when I worked out, his best man is 53 years his senior. Yeah. So in other words, that means that my son, if my son does a Macron, his best man is currently 63 and he's 10.
Yeah.
That's quite hard.
But that's not going to happen, is it?
Well, I would be absolutely astounded if that, if Arthur's future best man is more than a decade my senior. I think Macron clearly, we talked right at the beginning about de Gaulle writing that story about himself, General de Gaulle beating the Germans when he was 15. It was a very sort of Churchillian thing to do. Macron clearly has that sense. I mean, there are lots of stories about him saying to people when he was at school,
well,
I'm going to be president of France, I'm going to lead France, all this kind of stuff.
I think he is the embodiment of huge numbers of the trends that we've talked about in a kind of very, very self-conscious way. So he's been most recently in the news, aside from the election, for the role that he's played in essentially keeping lines of communication open with Putin.
He wants to be the man at the end of that long table.
He does, but he also wants to situate France midway between...
Yeah, he does.
Between China, Russia, whatever, and the United States. So he said that NATO is brain dead. He's very keen on that.
Yes.
He's incredibly hostile to Britain. I mean, that's another kind of theme of you know, that's a kind of Gaullist tradition, I guess. Yeah. He had a great grandfather from Bristol.
Oh, really?
Who'd fought in the First World War and who then cheated on his wife and ran off.
And that's why.
That is a theory as to why he's relatively...
But he also does that. He also absolutely, absolutely incarnates that thing that to an Anglo-Saxon viewer of treading that very fine line between being sort of impressive and being utterly ridiculous. So wearing the hoodie, the Paris hoodie,
yeah,
in emulation.
That was very sweet. I think he's much more impressive than ridiculous.
Or posing in the last 2 days, Tom, showing off his bare chest. Have you seen this?
Chest. That's what the French do. I mean, what's his name?
Jean-Paul Sartre didn't do that.
Bernard Henri Lévy does it.
Does
he's
he?
Always showing off his chest.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I mean,
at least you're not going in for like ludicrous. We absolutely haven't gone in for ludicrous national stereotypes in this podcast. That's one thing we've very much stayed clear
of. I think Macron is I mean, I think he's the most impressive current Western leader by a long, long way. I don't think it's necessarily been good for France, because I think that a healthy democratic system depends on healthy parties of the left and the right contesting one another. And I think that he has essentially, by annihilating that, I think he's put French democracy in quite a kind of treacherous state, quite an awkward state. But I think that as a political leader, as an embodiment of his nation, I think he's indisputably impressive. He's charismatic. You know, his achievement in becoming president at the young age he has done.
There's a definite trend here, Tom, because you love Tony Blair as well. And they're
I think he's a very Blairite figure.
He is a very
Blairite
figure.
I do like
figure.
These kind of, charismatic.
You like kind of...
Charismatic centrists.
Charismatic centrists who undo too many buttons, basically.
Maybe.
That's what you look for in a man.
Well, but don't you think he's impressive? I mean, he's more impressive than Schultz or Johnson or Biden or...
Well, he's younger than Biden. That's
I mean, indisputably. I mean, Biden could be his best man.
He could. Yes, that's very true. Yeah, he could be married to Mrs. Biden and have Joe as his best man.
But you think, I agree. It's not a, you know, the current crop of Western leaders aren't amazing, but I think.
Well, what I think is great politicians, or very successful politicians, they have a profound consciousness of themselves being in the gaze of history. And of playing a part. You know, they walk onto stage and they're conscious that all eyes are on them and they rise to that. I mean, I always think of there's an amazing clip actually of Macron, because he was very young. He was president at 39. And there's a clip of him soon after he becomes president and he's going on a walk about and there's all crowds and there's kids, teenagers. And one of them shouts at him as he walks past, "Ça va, Manu? You know, how's it going?" And Macron stops with the cameras on him and he goes back to this boy and he says, basically, "I'm not Manu to you. You call me Mr. President." And I thought, you know, in Britain, if a prime minister behaved like that, people would say, God, the prime minister, what a terrible ass.
Well, Don Prescott's the model for how to behave. Yeah. In a situation like that, you punch him. He's got a mullet. And we should explain that that's a reference to John Prescott, Tony Blair's deputy prime minister, who got hit by an egg.
Yeah, who punched a protester. Exactly. But Macron doing that, Macron has this tremendous sense of the grandeur of France, that thing that we talked about at the beginning. And I think that's... I mean, it's terrible to degenerate international stereotypes as much as we've done. But obviously, that is a key element of the French presidency, this monarchical sense.
But we said right from the beginning that that is what you have to measure up to. And that by that standard, Macron, I think, is probably the most impressive president since de Gaulle. And so by the time you listen to this, you'll know whether he has obtained re-election or not. I think that even if he does, I think France is in a bit of a mess because... I imagine that the Marine Le Pen will have done better than she did in the previous time that these two figures contested the election.
Last time, I think, didn't she?
And we haven't really talked about the Le Pens, but they are kind of a shadow lurking in the background because the French presidency was set up by de Gaulle, who defined himself against the Vichy tradition.
Yeah.
And in a way, the Le Pens embody that kind of the Vichy tradition. So there's a sense in which there is a political tradition there that is antithetical to de Gaulle and therefore perhaps to the entire idea of the presidency as it was formulated by de Gaulle.
I think that's fair because actually that goes back even earlier than Vichy, Tom, because Marine Le Pen's father, who basically founded her party and founded her movement, even though they've fallen out with each other, he was first involved in politics with a group that was associated with a group called Action Française, which was a far-right movement, ultra-Catholic, ultra-royalist, dating from the late 19th century, that was opposed to the very idea of the Republic.
And he's a monarchist, isn't he?
In some ways, you could say that's what the Le Pen political movement represents.
And also talking about the idea of being antithetical to what de Gaulle represents, Jean-Marie Le Pen was very, very opposed to Algeria, de Gaulle's Algerian policy.
Well, Jean-Marie Le Pen was an intelligence officer in Algeria.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are rumors involved with torture or whatever. Yeah. So many people were. So, there is a sort of – people forget that before the Second World War, French politics had been incredibly conflicted. The very existence of the Republic had been up for debate. There had been talk of civil war in the 1930s. And those kind of ruptures, obviously they're very different now. But the sort of – I don't know, I'm mixing my metaphors terribly, but the kind of aftershocks of all that, the reverberations of it, they're still there to this day. And the Le Pen movement, it's not just, it's the left behind, people across about immigration or globalization or whatever. It has deeper roots, I think, that go back
to
sort of late 19th century, early 20th century France, the Dreyfus case and all this kind of stuff.
Yes. And of course, someone who we haven't mentioned who definitely won't become president because he's been knocked out is Eric Zemmour. Even though he's Jewish, has kind of chuntered a little bit about whether Dreyfus was actually innocent.
And has
kind of chuntered about whether Vichy was really as bad as people have said. And Marine Le Pen, I mean, we should say, has adopted a policy of trying to clear things up. So she has fallen out with her father. She's expelled him from the party. They've renamed the Front National, the National Front. I can't remember what she calls it now, but changed the name.
National Rally, always, I think it is.
Something like that. And she's always posing with her cats, isn't she? She's a Persian cat breeder.
Is she? Ali Ansari would be impressed by that behavior.
Yes. She has, tried to tidy things up. And I guess you could, the other thing is that, again, seems very, very striking, actually looking the whole way back over these presidents, is how very, very right-wing France is.
Yeah.
And we tend not to think of France as being right-wing, I suppose, because of the revolution.
Yeah.
But, the vast majority of these presidents have been on the right, all of them except for Mitterrand and Hollande. Macron, I mean, he's clearly veered to the right, I think.
Definitely,
drifted to the right.
Yes.
You could say about Le Pen, although she's described as far right, her policies, her economic policies, her social policies are very, very... left-wing.
Well,
I mean, much more left-wing than...
They're protectionist.
And since, that is the intriguing element in this election is that Mélenchon, who's the kind of the French Corbyn, picked up, he came third just behind Marine Le Pen. Where will his votes go? because it's not immediately obvious that, that Macron would be more appealing to them.
Yeah,
know,
I think it's
kind of a globalist liberal, you know.
It's a very good point you make, Tom, about French politics. And I think people often get that wrong, particularly in Britain, because in Britain, where France is kind of the other, I think particularly people on the liberal left have a fantasy image of France. They think it's all kind of sipping rosé wine and leafy gardens and wearing polo necks and talking about existentialism. But in reality, I mean, I can remember very vividly, just to end on a kind of note of utter self-indulgence. When I was a language assistant in France in the mid-1990s, I remember once in, it was 1995 or six, so there were, the Le Pen sort of bandwagon was really underway, but also the arguments about Islam were really sort of kicking off. And I can remember at one point very foolishly thinking this would be a good idea to have a conversation about this with my kind of 17, 18-year-old students. And they lived in a affluent sort of town in the south of France. I assumed utterly naively that they would think just like I did and my contemporaries in England, because obviously I didn't know anybody in England who was on the kind of far right. And I mentioned Le Pen in this sort of dismissive way, or gosh, isn't it shocking that Jean-Marie Le Pen gets so much support? And I couldn't believe how many of these, you know, trendy, good-looking 17, 18-year-olds, you know, not at all left behind kind of people, thought Le Pen was tremendous. And actually, the first thing they generally said was, well, he'll clear up all the Arabs.
They said that to you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Without the slightest sense of shame, or in a way that I don't think a similar group of people in England
or Scotland, by and large, the sense in England and Scotland is that people under the age, say, of 25 will identify with Jeremy Corbyn or with Nicola Sturgeon and see them as kind of progressive.
By the radicals. Way, if you're Welsh, we haven't forgotten you.
Yes, I don't know how. Yeah, I guess, I mean, young Welsh voters likewise would vote for Labour, I guess. You know, they'd be anti-Tory. They'd be anti-Tory.
The assumption that young people are more liberal, which doesn't work in France.
I gather that the overwhelming majority of under 25s in France are voting Le Pen.
Well, seem unusual. We shall see if that happens. But historically, Tom, the Front National has done well with young voters. And very that sort of turns on its head what.
But not
Anglo-Saxons,
it's not Le Front National anymore, is it? We should
no,
add
it's okay.
That.
It's not the Front National, but it's basically the same. right.
Or is it? I mean, I don't know what you think about that. So there is debate about that.
Yeah.
About how much it's changed.
Okay. No,
to
that's
what
fair
extent
enough.
Le Pen fee would be. I mean, she's definitely a different order of politician to her father, who was an incredibly sinister figure.
But the lineage, you can't deny the lineage.
I do. Yeah.
Yes. Well, maybe she's president now and we're talking about the new president of France, but I don't think she will be. So,
But that also is a kind of interest, just to return to something I mentioned earlier, the how masculine the French presidency has always been.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true.
So contrast there. Could I just also mention one other intriguing detail about the French president?
Go on.
He is also the co-prince of Andorra.
Yes, he is. So that's a great important. Thing, isn't it?
Again, it kind of unsettles our sense of
I think the French
republicanism.
I think he should make more of that. I would make more of that if I was
president.
Well,
Macron does. I think Macron is quite keen on the whole co-prince of Andorra.
And I mean, Sarkozy looks like the Prince of Andorra.
Yes, he does. He does.
Well, he's at home with the tag, Sarkozy. You've seen this? He's because he's got a suspended sentence for corruption. So he's got permission to spend it at home with a electronic
with
tag.
Carla.
With Carla.
Yeah. And Carla. And Chirac had a suspended sentence as well.
It's basically comes with comes with a massive salary.
Yeah. Anyway, on that note.
This has been an incredibly
a fair,
nuanced.
Reasonable, nuanced portrait. And not in any way Anglo-Saxon take on the French presidency. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope it complements whatever the result of the election is. And we will see you soon.
Okay.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. À la prochaine.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Ah!
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.